All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is American Vindicta, and I'm your host, Doug Thornton. Today is going to be a day full of mythical interests, a scouring of factual evidence, and hopefully I can put it all together to give you my introduction of who were the SS of Nazi Germany. Now, episode 42 is primarily going to be about the SS, but we have some other things to throw in there, like the Nazi mysticism and occultism. We're going to touch on that a little bit. It's hard to really find historical documents on this because previously back in the 40s and 50s, 60s, when people were researching about all this, they didn't take very much context into the Nazi mysticism or occultism. And there's a lot of hearsays, there's a lot of rumors, there's a lot of fantastical writings. But I will assure you that I will give you the best of what I know and what I can find. And our dearly departed brother, Russ Dizdar, was probably one of the best Christian experts out there when it came to Nazi occultism. If you just probably just go to YouTube and look up Russ Dizdar and Nazi occultism, you'll find so many different videos made by him. Going to Wewelburg Castle, which is the Nazi Temple of Doom, and all of his experiences with that. And it is truly intriguing. One of the probably most entertaining things to listen to when it comes to the history of Nazi occultism. And Russ does just such a fantastic job, especially coming at it as a viewpoint of a pastor. So please check out Russ's work and, you know, let's keep his memory alive. So without further ado, if we're going to talk about the SS, we have to talk about the man who really catapulted the SS above and beyond what it originally was going to be. And the SS was originally just a protective unit that was specifically made for Adolf Hitler, and it was really supposed to stay just as that, but because of a man named Heinrich Himmler, it went so far politically, militarily, based off law enforcement, and occultic, that by the end of World War II, the way Heinrich Himmler had saw it was that the SS were going to become the new priests, the occultic Nazi priests of the world. And they were going to centralize the spirituality of the world around Wewelburg Castle, the Nazi Temple of Doom. And we're going to get into that part a little bit later, and there's just so much information out there. Once again, we're going to be resourcing a lot of this out of the Encyclopedia of the United States Holocaust Museum, Memorial Museum. It's probably one of the best historically wrote, historically accurate websites that you can go to find all this material. But, you know, I would venture for you to, you know, find stuff like NaziGermany.build, Britannica.com also has some pretty good stuff. Cambridge.org has some pretty good stuff on there. And War History Online. So these are the resources that we're going to be using today. And once again, me as your narrator, my whole goal is not to travel back in time and redo history. My goal is to try and compile all this together so that it's easy for you to understand, hopefully somewhat entertaining, and refreshing your mind about what the future of the world may hold for us. Now, we know that for all of us Christians out there, we look upon the world through biblical lenses, and we should be revisiting Revelation here and there in our Bible and looking and investigating ourselves into what the New World Order would look like, what the Antichrist army would look like. I and many others out there, I'm sure, would be willing to say that the Nazi empire and the Nazi occultism is a very good picture of history for what the future may hold. Now, once again, it's a little saying I've been working on and I've been trying to work through, and you know, everyone has their quotes and they have their standards for what they like to say for the introductions of all their shows, and I'm still working on that. I'm not as cool as all these other guys, but for me, what I want to do is I want to weaponize history. I want to use history as a weapon to fight the future evil. Because if we do not remember history, if we do not teach history to the younger generation that is going to take our place, they may very well repeat it. Now, we have a young generation who are, you know, probably the most well-knowledged of any history based off of the amount of historical context that is at their fingertips and the availability and means of gaining historical context. However, most of our young generation are not in the realms of research. They don't really care about history. They care about the here, they care about the now, and they care about the next. The problem is when you don't research of what came before, you may stumble down a road that is paved with good intentions and find yourself walking straight into hell. So that's why we are going to go over the Nazi SS. We're going to go over who their leadership was, their background, a little bit of an overview. I find it to be fascinating when you really research this, chew it down to the bone, just how much law enforcement was based off of the Nazi system. It was one of the main tactics that they used to control and strangle the German people. And once again, that's another thing that I want to make note as we see the light of January 6th, the arrest of some political figures here and there in America, that if we do not also help our current law enforcement and government remember the war crimes of the past of the Nazis, not just the Nazis, but also of the Russian commissars or of the Maoists, we themselves, because I was former law enforcement, may also repeat it, because when you say, I was just doing my job, it was just a paycheck, I was just ordered to take these people from here to there, you are repeating sprinklings of the past, and it can put us on a very dangerous path in America. Now, I don't know if I've ever cleared this up for people, but I seek no reason or want to overthrow the government or to destroy any part of our government. I think, for one thing, our government is so big now, there's really nothing you can do about it. That's a little bit of a nihilistic approach, but I mean, in reality, when the people at the top, the elite, the political elite, when they hold all the keys, what can a people do? The only real person who can really save us from our collapsing future is our Lord Jesus. So, do not forget to dismay hope. Remember that Jesus is our hope. He is our light. He is our Savior. And we are going to go through very ugly times, and that is one reason why I'm bringing this up. So that when you see a repeat of history, you should not be shocked. You should not be so surprised when we start to repeat our history. So, climbing down off of my soapbox now, we are going to discuss Heinrich Himmler. So, who was Heinrich Himmler? Well, Heinrich Himmler was born in 1900 and died in 1945. He was born October 7, 1900, and died May 23rd, 1945, while in British detainment, while he was being detained by the Allies. He died by a cyanide capsule, a true coward's death. And for the most part, that was Nazi Germany. Truly cowardice men who hid behind terror and weapons. Once again, hopefully a past that we don't repeat in this country. Heinrich Himmler was the Reich leader, the Reichsführer of the dreaded SS of the Nazi Empire from 1929 until 1945. Himmler presided over a vast ideological and bureaucratic empire that defined him for many, both inside and outside the Third Reich, as the second most powerful man after Adolf Hitler in Germany during World War II. Now, given overall responsibility for the security of the Nazi Empire, Himmler was the key and senior Nazi official responsible for conceiving and overseeing the implementation of the Final Solution, the Nazi plan to murder the Jews of Europe, the Holocaust. Himmler was born into a middle-class conservative Catholic family in Munich, Germany on October 7th, 1900. His father, Gebhard, taught at the Ludwig Academic High School in Munich. In 1913, Himmler's family moved to Lundstedt, a town located about 40 miles northwest of Munich. After Himmler, Sr., took the job of assistant principal of the gymnasium in Landshut, as a youth, Himmler was fervently patriotic. During World War I, he dreamed of service on the front line as an officer, and using his reluctant father's connections, he had left high school to begin training as an officer candidate in January 1, 1918. On November 11, 1918, however, before Himmler's training was complete, Germany signed the armistice that would end World War I. Himmler graduated from high school in Landshut in July 1919. After the restrictions imposed on Germany by the Versailles Peace Treaty dashed his hopes of joining the army, he studied agriculture at the Technical University in Munich. There, he joined a German nationalist student fraternity and began to read deeply in the racist, nationalist, Volkisch literature, which was a popular on the right, the radical right, of the interwar German political spectrum. By the time he received his university degree in August 1922, Himmler was a fanatical Volkisch nationalist and a political activist. Just real quick, I do not read German very well, so bear with me. Forced to take a job in a manure processing factory in Schleißheim, near Munich, Himmler made contact with the National Socialists through the Stormtrooper's chief of staff, Ernest Röhm. In August 1923, he joined the Nazi Party, to which he devoted his career after he quit his job 1 month later. On November 9, 1923, Himmler marched with Hitler, Röhm, Hermann Göring, and other Nazi leaders in the Beer Hall push against the German government, which was a form of a coup d'etat. Unemployed and at loose ends after the collapse of the coup d'etat, Himmler found work as a secretary and personal assistant to Gregor Strasser, whom Hitler appointed the Reich propaganda leader of the Nazi Party in 1926. Himmler also built his own reputation in the party as a speaker and organizer. His speeches stressed the following themes: a racist consciousness, cult of the German race, the need for German expansion and settlements, the struggle against eternal enemies of Germany. Now, these eternal enemies were Jewish capitalism, Marxism, socialism, communism, anarchism, liberal democracy, and the Slavic people. In 1928, he married Margaret Bowden, And in 1929, his daughter, Gudrun, was born. In January 1929, Adolf Hitler, the Führer of the Nazi Party, appointed Himmler Reichsführer of the Schutzstaffel, the SS. The SS, which in 1929 totaled 280 men, was subordinate to the stormtroopers and had two major functions: to serve as bodyguards for Hitler and other Nazi leaders, and to hawk subscriptions for the Nazi newspaper. Now, the Nazi newspaper was called the Race Nationalist Observer. From this insignificant beginning, Himmler perceived an opportunity to develop an elite core of the Nazi Party. By the time the Nazis seized power in January 1933, the SS numbered more than 52,000 men. Himmler also introduced two key functions to the SS that related to the Nazi Party's long-term core goals for Germany. He introduced internal security and guardianship over racial purity. After deploying his men, the SS, in April 1931 to crush a revolt by the Berlin stormtroopers against Hitler's leadership, inspiring the adoption of the SS motto that was given to them by Hitler, "My honor is loyalty," Himmler created the security service, the SD. Now, you're going to hear these acronyms, SA, SS, SD. The SS obviously was the Schutzstaffel. The SA are the brown shirts, the stormtroopers. And the SD is the security service. The SD kept tabs on Hitler's opponents within the Nazi Party and gathered intelligence on leaders and activities of other political parties, as well as on government officials, both federal and local. In August 1934, Nazi Party Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess announced that the security service would henceforth be the sole political intelligence gathering and evaluating agency in the Third Reich. On the last day of 1931, Himmler also established a Race and Settlement Office to evaluate applications of SS men seeking to marry under a new internal marriage decree. The expertise developed in this role of maintaining racial purity in the SS would, in wartime, determine whether an individual was German or not. At a minimum, a positive determination meant a job and better rations in German-occupied territory during World War II. At a maximum, the decision of ethnicity could be a decision on life and death. In the 5 years after the Nazis seized power in January 1933, Himmler built an unassailable position for the SS by taking control of the German police forces. On March 9, 1933, he was appointed provisional president of police in Munich. 3 weeks later, he was named commander of the Bavarian political police. By late 1934, Himmler sought and obtained command of each of the state police, police departments, and political police in Germany, and had centralized them with a single new agency in Berlin, the Secret State Police, better known as the Gestapo. After Hitler appointed him Reichsführer SS and Chief of German Police on January 17, 1936, Himmler centralized the various criminal police detective forces in Germany into the Reich Criminal Police Office and united the Gestapo and the criminal police in the Security Police main office. In September 1939, Himmler fused the Security Police and the Security Police into the Reich Security Main Office, Security Service, the SD. The agency that would be tasked with implementing the Holocaust in 1941 and 1942. Himmler also unified and centralized the uniform police forces in Germany, the Order Police. In 1933 and 34, Himmler also secured for his SS control over centralized concentration camp systems. Although various civilian authorities and police agencies had established autonomous concentration camps during 1933 to incarcerate political enemies of the Nazi government, Hitler was so impressed with the Dachau concentration camp established by the SS in March 1933 that Hitler authorized Himmler to create a centralized concentration camp system. Though the SS and corporate of concentration camps reduced the number of concentration camps to 4 in 1937, the system grew in wartime to include 30 to 40 main camps and hundreds of sub-camps. SS camp authorities would kill around 2 million prisoners. Those prisoners were Jewish, they were political prisoners, Roma gypsies, so-called asocials, recidivists, convicts, homosexuals, Jehovah's Witnesses, and others, to include homeless, mentally impaired, mentally handicapped, and physically handicapped persons. Also people of other races. As a reward for its role in murdering Ernst Röhm and the top leadership of the stormtroopers, the brown shirts, on June 30th and July 2nd, 1934, Hitler announced that the SS was an independent organization and that Himmler was subordinate to Hitler in Hitler's new capacity as Führer of Germany. This position places authority outside the legal constraints of the German state. The command relationship between Hitler and Himmler was the basis of the immense power that Himmler accumulated during World War II. By tying the German police forces organizationally to the SS, Himmler effectively removed police personnel, finances, actions, and operations from external judicial or administrative review. As the Reichsführer of the SS, Himmler received authority directly from Hitler to carry out ideological policies that the laws of the state might not permit. This ideological rooted Führer authority enabled authorization of indefinite incarceration and mass murder. The Nazi leaders justified this extra legal chain of command and the policies initiated under its authorization by the national emergency legislation following the Reichstag fire in 1933 and the intensified emergency created by the war. We are going to go to a quick break and we'll be right back.
The time for political correctness is in the rearview mirror. The fact is, the American dollar is on the verge of collapse. It's been abused mightily by those in power. Massive debt, massive inflation have left Americans with few options. Most think they have no choice but to ride it out with their money in the bank. And sadly, they're going to awaken one day and all that money is going to be gone. Do you have an option? The answer is yes. Precious metals. But knowing to go into precious metals is not the same thing as knowing who to go into precious metals with. We have an answer for you. It's called Renaissance Precious Metals. It's owned and operated by the famed Steve Quayle, radio talk show host, world famous, and an expert in precious metals. Been doing the work for 34 years. So whether you're interested in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, whatever your interest is, wherever you want to land in your escape pod, this is it. Renaissance Precious Metals can be reached at 406-586-4842. Call Steve Quayle at 406-586-4842. You can also visit them online at sqmetals.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait. The collapse is underway. The time to act is now.
And welcome back. This is American Vindicta. So we're going to continue to read about Himmler and the expansion of Himmler's authority during World War II. Heinrich Himmler expanded his authority during the war. On October 7, 1939, shortly after Germany conquered and partitioned Poland with the Soviet Union, Hitler appointed Himmler Reich Commissar for the strengthening of German ethnic stock. This position authorized Himmler and the SS to plan, initiate, and control the pace of German resettlement projects in occupied Poland and later the Soviet Union. This was all part of a dream that Himmler and Hitler had for a long time about more of a prophetic view of the German people pushing eastward for new settlements and territories. Organizations under Himmler, under Himmler's command, had the final say over who was German, where ethnic Germans should live, and what population should be moved out or annihilated in order to make room for the German settlers. In July 1941, Hitler extended Himmler's authority for both security and resettlement operations to the occupied Soviet Union. Himmler's exclusive responsibility for the security behind the immediate front line authorized the mobile Einsatzgruppen and other SS and police units to initiate and direct the mass murder of Jews, Soviet officials, Roma gypsies, and people with disabilities living in institutions with the support of German military and civilian occupation authorities. With Hitler's agreement, the SS, within its responsibilities for security and settlement issues, assumed the leadership role in planning and implementing the final solution of the Jewish question, as well as annihilation operation throughout the Reich against Roma gypsies and people with disabilities living in institutions. In 1937, the SS had taken control of the Ethnic German Liaison Office, which ministered to the needs of ethnic Germans living outside of the Reich. Among those needs were clothing and household equipment for newly resettled ethnic German communities. These items the SS supplied in part from the personal property taken from Jews murdered at the killing centers. Perhaps in reflection of the growing power of the SS and the state, Hitler appointed Himmler Minister of the Interior in July 1943. In order to strengthen the position of the SS relative to the established German elites after a victorious war, Himmler persuaded Hitler in late 1939 to permit the establishment of an armed SS paramilitary force known as the Waffen-SS. Although initially restricted to four divisions, the Waffen-SS eventually fielded more than 20 divisions, putting 500,000 men under arms and establishing a command of operations structure that rivaled the German army. That same year, Himmler established a separate SS disciplinary system. Since neither civilian nor military courts had jurisdiction to investigate criminal acts perpetrated by members of the SS and police or their auxiliary units. As military defeats reduced the prestige of the generals in Hitler's view, Himmler's SS further encroached on the authority of the German armed forces. In February 1944, the security police and the security services took over control of the Armed Forces Intelligence Service. After the failure of the military coup d'etat July 20, 1944, Hitler appointed Himmler commander of the replacement army, a position responsible for training and overseeing military personnel, and gave him command of matters relating to prisoners of war. In December 1944, Himmler realized his old dream to have had a command in the field when Hitler appointed him Commander-in-Chief of Army Group Upper Rhine in southwestern Germany. Despite appearances to the outside, Himmler was not all-powerful in the Third Reich. His most significant and powerful rival during the last year of the war was Martin Bormann, Hitler's secretary and chief of the Nazi Party Chancellery. The Nazi Party apparatus, anchored in the political power of the Nazi Party district leaders, who also held positions in the state as regional defense commissars, became more significant with the invasion of the Allied armies toward the end of the war. Likewise, Albert Speer, the Reich Minister of Armaments and War Production, wielded great power in the last years of the war despite his post-war protestations and powerlessness vis-a-vis the SS. And that's mainly because the SS also tried to take over the armaments and war production away from Albert Speer. A skilled organizer and a capable manager who understood how to obtain and use power, Heinrich Himmler was the ideological and organizational driving force behind the rise of the SS. Moreover, he understood his SS men and knew how to secure their loyalty to his own person and to the concept of the Nazi elite to which they belonged. His ability to give his subordinates leeway to exercise initiative to implement Nazi policy was a significant factor in the murderous success of many SS operations. When he took over the SS, Himmler recognized the importance of internal security and determination of racial purity for the Nazi movement and successfully expanded the functions of the SS to meet these ideological and practical needs. Himmler understood the importance of police power separated from legal constraint and state supervision. He persuaded Hitler over the arguments of powerful rivals in the party and in the state that fusion of the SS and police would forge the instrument for the Nazi regime to achieve its core long-term ideological goals. It was Himmler whom Hitler entrusted with the planning and implementation of the final solution. In his most quoted speech, that of October 4th, 1943 in Poznan, to a gathering of SS generals, Himmler explicitly justified the mass murder of the European Jews in these following words. In front of you here, I want to refer explicitly to a very serious matter. I mean here, the annihilation of the Jewish people. Most of you will know what it means when 100 corpses lie side by side, or 500, or 1,000. This page of glory in our history has never been written and will never be written. We had the moral right. We were obligated to our people to kill this people which wanted to kill us. After the failure of the July 20th, 1944 attempt to assassinate Hitler, Heinrich Himmler toyed with the idea of negotiating a separate peace with the Western Allies while continuing to fight the Soviet Union. During the winter of 1944 and 45, he considered using concentration camp prisoners as a bargaining chip to initiate such negotiations. In April 1945, Himmler met with the representative of the World Jewish Congress in Stockholm, Sweden, Hillel Storch, to discuss openings for negotiations, in part because the Allies would not negotiate with a man so implicated in the Nazi crimes, and in part because Himmler could not quite separate himself from Hitler or the belief that somehow the Germans would win the war. His half-hearted feelers came to nothing. In April 1945, Himmler asked Count Folke Bernadotte, the vice president of the Swedish Red Cross, to transmit an offer of surrender on the Western Front to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, the commander-in-chief of the Allied forces. The news of the offer reached Hitler in encircled Berlin on the night of April 28th and 29th, 1945. In one of his last official acts, Hitler stripped Himmler of all of his offices and ordered for his arrest. Despite having continuously assured his SS officers and the men that he ultimately would take responsibility for all of their actions. The end of the war found Himmler dressed in secret field police uniform with a disguise with papers in the name of Heinrich Hitzinger. He was captured by Russian soldiers on May 20, 1945, where he was turned over to the British, to whom he eventually confessed his identity. While undergoing a body search on May 23, 1945, Himmler killed himself by biting down on a cyanide capsule hidden in his mouth for that very purpose. We're going to go to a break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is American Vindicta. We are now going to move past Heinrich Himmler, and we are going to discuss the Waffen SS, the Armed SS, which was the paramilitary force, the ferocious, elite, cream-of-the-crop fighting force of the Nazi Wehrmacht, the Nazi military. The Waffen SS proved to be a highly effective fighting force. It was considered the cream of the crop of the Nazi war machine, and they were trained and indoctrinated to be the new social and military elite of the Third Reich. They performed the roles of the elite shock troop units on every front, receiving praise and grudging respect from both allies and foes. They were Hitler's favored warriors and would be the tip of the spear that drove into Russia and Germany's shield as it was assailed on all sides by its foes. They fought to be to the bitter end and bought time for their Wehrmacht comrades to fall back and fought tooth and nail to achieve impossible goals imposed by Adolf Hitler. To understand this military unit fully, one must first look at its training and who its soldiers are. The Waffen SS was the creation of Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS and the Gestapo. He was trying to create a new Aryan elite within the Third Reich and believed that his military units needed to be the best within Nazi Germany. However, Himmler understood that this new Aryan elite needed to live up to the standard of elite, but also needed to be a break from the old elite of Germany. This resulted in Heinrich creating a rigorous and deeply indoctrinative training regimen that would turn simple soldiers into zealous warriors that were unmatched in physical prowess and courage that became the personal favorite of Adolf Hitler. The men admitted into the SS were to be no older than the age of 23 and stand at least 5'9". They were to be of Nordic or Germanic blood and needed to be clean of mutation or malformation. These were the requirements to even be considered to join the SS, and if one would fulfill these requirements, then they would take multiple physical and mental tests before being admitted as a recruit of the Waffen SS. In the early stages of the Waffen SS creation between 1933 and 1936, Himmler's resources were rather scant, and his Waffen SS would be trained in the basics of military tactics and strategy by the Wehrmacht. However, this only affected their officers' tactical prowess. For the Waffen SS line infantry themselves were trained as an assault infantry, like the British Commandos and the United States Army Rangers. Eventually, Himmler's troops' quality resulted in Hitler allowing the Waffen SS assault troops to practice large-scale military training operations with live ammunition and artillery barrages in 1938. Giving the Waffen SS valuable experience with their weapons and experiments and equipments in the field. This was unique for the Waffen SS. For Hitler normally made the Wehrmacht perform a far more cautious and safe approach to training operations. Himmler would compensate for the lack of proper tactical and strategic training with ensuring his men were at the physical peak of their lives and also completely ideologically indoctrinated. Himmler would make physical training one of the most important parts of the Waffen-SS's training and ensured the various sports such as boxing, running track and field, rowing, and others were integrated throughout the day, creating not only fit and healthy troops, but also building the camaraderie within the Waffen-SS. As a training manual, the Waffen-SS cited by Bird Wegner states, "Sport arouses belligerence. It hardens the will. It promotes self-discipline and therefore promotes the training of the SS man to the level of a combat-effective fighter. Sport forces on to accept subordination and strengthens the cohesion and esprit de corps of the troops. In addition, it should also afford the SS man relaxation and rest and give him pleasure." This shows that Himmler understood the importance of balance when training his men and ensured that they not only enjoyed the training, but would also find it as a release from the indoctrination they would undertake, similar to that of the students going to the gym or playing sports to relieve stress. Steiner, a leading officer within the Waffen-SS and commander of the Deutschland Division, expressed his views on the sport-orientated training of the Waffen-SS as follows regarding to the troops under his command. "They are a disciplined sport type, of supple physical stature, and mentally concentrated on performance. He took pride in his men's physical ability to carry out extremely mobile shock assault actions while maintaining full combat effectiveness." Now, the ideological indoctrination is probably one of the things that separated the SS from everyone else, to include Allied forces. Just as important as the physical training, Himmler ensured the Waffen-SS were ideologically fit for service. In fact, an education officer at the Liebestandarte Adolf Hitler is recorded saying that his job was similar to that of the Red Army's political commissars. He purposely took old traditional ideas and twisted their meanings into something completely different but useful for his agenda. Ideas of loyalty, courage, and self-sacrifice for the nation would be twisted to have loyalty to Hitler, Himmler, and the SS. Be courageous when fighting the enemies of the Nazis, and sacrifice for the Aryan people as well as your fellow SS. The focus of the SS indoctrination was blood and soil, which encompasses the ideas of loyalty and courage and self-sacrifice. Bernd Wegner emphasized the importance of loyalty of the SS by stating, "For the SS, loyalty was channeled exclusively into the person of Adolf Hitler, regardless of the office he held. This personification of loyalty, so vividly expressed in the form of the SS Oath of Allegiance, a breach of loyalty was the only unforgivable crime of an SS man." The Oath of Loyalty to Hitler is perhaps the greatest example of the SS undying allegiance and fanaticism to fulfill his orders, wherein they state, "I vow to you, Adolf Hitler, as Führer and Chancellor of the German Reich, loyalty and bravery. I vow to you and the leaders you set before me absolute allegiance unto death. So God help me." Their motto is, "Our honor is loyalty," which enforces the idea of utter loyalty to Hitler and Himmler, and by extension, the SS as a whole. Himmler sought to create a professional political soldier. Since 1934, he would be completely loyal to Hitler and indirectly to himself when he believed he would become Hitler's right hand. The ideological indoctrination of the Waffen-SS was necessary for the soldiers to maintain their unity and allegiance to the SS as an organization over the Wehrmacht. For without the indoctrination, there would be no reason for the SS troops to be any different than the normal German soldiers ideologically. The SS were indoctrinated with the idea that they were the guardians of Germany from Bolshevism and inferior humans, and that the eventual war against the Polish and Russians would be an ideological crusade to both defend their people and destroy an evil. This resulted in battles that were so ferocious on the Eastern Front. Few can truly imagine the horror and brutality of the conflict. When voluntarily German SS troopers engaged fanatic communists in Russia in World War II, a climax in enmity and hatred was reached in which all traces of chivalry vanished and moderation was abandoned. Even to read about some of these battles with an attempt at imaginative understanding is sufficient to shake anyone to their depths. Okay, so now let's get into some of the most fantastical readings you're probably going to ever research when it comes to World War II. The Nazi Temple of Doom, Wewelsburg Castle. The SS revered the castle as a place of mystical power. And this was the home of Heinrich Himmler and the SS headquarters. Now, the castle of Wewelsburg overlooks a village of the same name in Westphalia, Germany. It once belonged to the Prince Bishops of Paderborn, and after that to the Kings of Prussia. In 1933, it went into the hands of Heinrich Himmler, who was the leading member of the Nazi Party and the head of the SS. And only pure Aryans were permitted to be members of the SS. Himmler was intensely interested in mysticism and occultism. He chose Wewelsburg as his home and the headquarters of the SS. More than that, he made Wewelsburg a kind of spiritual center for his strange beliefs. The SS revered the castle as a place of mystical power. It is located near the site of a battle of Teutoburg Forest, where German tribesmen defeated the armies of Rome in 9 BC. Himmler redesigned the castle and named its rooms after military heroes in the Teutonic history and folklore, such as King Arthur, King Henry the Lion, Wittekind, and Frederick the Great. The walls were decorated with swastikas, ancient Germanic runes, and other mystic German symbols. Unique tableware, painted with the same symbols, was made for the castle. The castle was filled with works of art glorifying the German people and their achievements, and in the basement was a huge swastika where SS heroes were cremated. Himmler also built a room with 12 pillars representing King Arthur's Knights of the Round Table. A sacred flame guarded each pillar. In fact, Himmler thought of Wewelsburg as a center of mystic power. 12 SS officers became the new Knights of the Round Table and performed occult rites in celebration of the National Socialist State, where Himmler would take the role as King Arthur. They believed the number 12 was a great significance. The SS was divided into 12 departments with 12 leaders. There were 12 pedestals in the castle vault and 12 spokes in the black sun, a symbol in the floor that's represented the 12 SS knights. Himmler believed that after the final victory of the German people in Wewelsburg would be the spiritual center of the world. The SS would become the priest of the new world. And before campaigns, the leading SS commanders were called to the castle to prepare them for spirituality. When Himmler issued members of the SS with rings engraved with skulls and mystic symbols, if the SS soldier died, these death head rings were brought back to Wavelsburg and placed in a casket. Nobody knows where those 11,500 rings are now, but it was rumored that they were buried in a nearby mountain. When the end of the Third Reich drew near, and all hope for a victory was lost, the castle commander fled to escape from the hands of the U.S. 3rd Armored Division. Himmler, however, had not forgotten about the castle, and even so late in the war, he ordered a SS major to destroy it. He did not want his bit of the Nazi ideology to fall into the hands of the Allies. So on Saturday, March 31st, 1945, the destruction of the castle was attempted, but a lack of explosives forced the SS men to choose to blow up only a couple of buildings and a tower and then set the rest on fire. They then quickly changed into civilian clothes and fled the area. In 1948, the restoration of the castle began, and in 1950, it became a museum and a youth hostel. 32 years later, it became a war memorial under the title Wavelsburg 1933-45, Kult und Terrorstadt der SS. The museum's history department was reopened in 2010. It has a permanent exhibit that represents the strange story of the SS activities in the castle. All right, we only have a little bit of time left, but let's carry on into some of the crazy things about Wavelsburg Castle. The best legal minds, doctors, and scientists volunteered for the SS and became officers there. The inner circle of the SS head, Heinrich Himmler, included jurists and doctors who led the campaigns of destruction or were commanders of concentration camps and deaths. And between 1936 and 41, some of these people met at Wavelsburg Castle in northwestern Germany once a year under Himmler's command to take part in satanic rituals and read cultish texts of German tribes. With Himmler as King Arthur and 12 SS officers as the 12 knights, these Nazi leaders gathered annually in knight's gear at a round table and tried to channel the pagan heroes of German legend. The castle was the pseudo-religious holy center of the SS. It was built in the late Middle Ages, and its walls were decorated with a symbol and Indo-European black sun symbol, which is similar to the swastika. The castle was believed to be the area where the German hero Arminius, also called Hermann de Schrusker, defeated the Roman army in 9 BC, essentially liberating the Germans from the Roman rule. According to the German legend, one of the castle's rooms served as a center of worship for the Holy Grail. Heinrich Himmler saw himself as a descendant of Henry the Fowler, king of Germany and founder of the German nation, according to German tradition. In the 10th century, Heinrich in German, destroyed the Slavic tribes in eastern Germany. Quedlinburg Abbey in Saxony, where the earlier Heinrich is buried, was a spiritual site for Himmler and his men. A labor camp was built in the area where thousands of slave workers expanded the castle so it could be a gathering place for the SS. On the eve of Germany's June 1941 invasion of Russia, SS leaders held their final meeting in the castle. After explaining the goal of the invasion and the role of the SS death squads in liquidating the Jews and Slavic population, Himmler and his men stood in the Holy Grail room to receive inspiration ahead of what they saw as the greatest moment in German history. Himmler ordered parts of the castle destroyed in 1945, but as we know, it did not get completely destroyed. Now it serves as this huge museum for World War II and of the SS, and it's a meeting place now for neo-Nazis, neo-folk bands, white supremacist groups, and satanic and mystic spiritualistic groups. It is these corners of history that attest to the important place of mystic faith in the worldview of the Nazi elite. Now, just in closing, I will say this. We have seen in recent history where we have many elites within our government and within our political atmosphere and the Hollywood elites who do some very similar worshiping tactics as the Nazis. Do your own investigation. research what we have discussed and start to see the similar lines being drawn to these other people that we have talked about previously. Now, Monday, we'll have a whole new aspect of German life that we're going to get into. And like I said, we're going to continue to take down the German Empire brick by brick and see what all we can find and discuss and share. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a hell of a day. It's been a lot of research, and I'm about to go and cut some firewood. So I'm going to let you go. Thank you for listening. Thank you for hanging in there with me. I hope you'll continue with me throughout this journey. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Doug Thornton. This is American Vindicta. Out.
Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum has said, "You will own nothing and you will love it." And that's represented by what's going on across the planet today, where the economy of the world is in free fall, and nowhere is it more in evidence than with our own President Biden deliberately trying to sabotage what we have, access to food, other resources. So Americans are in a unique position, really for the first time in our history. We're going to have to provide for ourselves or subject ourselves to the whim of the government. Do you really trust a government to feed you that left 1,000 Americans behind enemy lines in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So where do you go? When you ask the question, who's the best prepper out there today? There's only one answer. Ready Made Resources and Robert Griswold. I call him King Prepper, and that's how a lot of people think of him. You have everything there you'd want, from night vision to storable food, how to prepare cooking in emergency situations, books and videos on how to prepare alternative energy, communication, first aid that you wouldn't think of, natural antibiotics, you name it, Bob has it. Now, here's the good thing about Bob Griswold that no one else does but him. You don't have to buy anything to talk to him. If you're not sure where to start with your preparation, no obligation phone call directly to Bob. You can talk to him for free. Most people will charge you an arm and a leg for a half-hour conversation. That's not Bob Griswold. He cares about helping America get prepared. Go to readymaderesources.com, or you can call the number directly at 800-627-3809. Again, that contact information, readymaderesources.com, for the best prepping outfit in the country, or call Bob Griswold directly, 800-627-3809.